Do charter schools work for everyone?
Charter schools have to be very lean. We know that they tend to employ fewer administrators, fewer support personnel. They tend to channel more of their scarce resources directly into the classroom.
From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. How one Atlanta school prepares students for the future.
All of our students, when they come here, register for the school, and then we register them as our employees.
And as school lets out, don't fall down the summer slide.
No summer school, I'm free to shop till I drop.
It's an education vacation,
and the party never has to stop. We've got things to do.
Let's lower the summer achievement gap together after the news. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Graduation Achievement Charter School was founded in 2012 to help at-risk students earn their diplomas. But after 6 years of poor performance, Georgia's first virtual charter high school, an only alternative school within the state's charter system, is shutting down. The last senior class graduates later this month. Here with more about the future of virtual and alternative charter schools is Vanessa McCray. She's education reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Vanessa, good morning.
Hi, thanks to be here.
So 1,700 students will be left without a diploma when Graduation Achievement Charter School closes. Who are these students?
That was really one of the most compelling reasons why I wanted to write this story for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. What school officials told me about the population of students here is that they really reflect a high need, high risk population of students. What my research indicated is that about 77% are low income, as marked by free and reduced lunch eligibility, and a good 60% or more are over age for their grade. I was told that the average ninth grader is almost 17 when they enter. So these are kids who really... we're looking for a second chance, and in some cases, a last chance to finish their degree.
When you reported that school administrators argued unsuccessfully for the state to make some exceptions to the standards that they abide by in order to keep the school chartered, because of the student population, what about this particular student body made it difficult to succeed?
So the school leaders told me that what they struggled with was having students who were not as prepared when they entered the school because they had, in many cases, been expelled from another school or had dropped out or who lagged behind severely. And so that, of course, affected their test scores, and that's the basis on which this school and other state charter schools are ultimately assessed.
Is that the sole assessment metric?
There's a number of different factors, but when it comes to the academic achievement portion, the State Commission, which is the group that authorizes state charter schools like Graduation Achievement, looks at various ways of measuring their academic success. And the State Charter School Commission argues that they have in their measurement baked in ways to level the playing field and account for disadvantaged students. Of course, Graduation Achievement says they needed even more leeway in order to meet these expectations.
Given their student population.
Correct.
Well, in this commercial, a Graduation Achievement student talks about what he's been able to accomplish through the online charter school format.
I was in a mental facility for 2 years in Augusta, which had a school there. Both schools messed up my credits terribly. My credits were on a special education track. I wanted to have a high school diploma, and I didn't know they would put me all the way back in ninth grade as an 18-year-old. So I wanted to come to Graduation Achievement. One of the things I'm so excited about is that I get to graduate in December because I have 29.5 credits and I only need two more to graduate.
A very hopeful ad campaign anyway, but the school did fail to meet academic state standards. So where exactly did it fail?
So the rub for Graduation Achievement came in meeting the academic performance benchmarks that the State Charter School Commission lays out. The State Charter School Commission authorizes Graduation Achievement in about 30 other charter schools, and it expects, in exchange for flexibility and state funding, that charter schools like Graduation Achievement will be able to outperform traditional districts. And the school was frankly just unable to meet that academic benchmark in any of the years that the commission reviewed. And that's even using various formulas that the state commission creates specifically to try to account for and weigh for disadvantaged student populations.
So what was the graduation rate at Graduation Achievement?
So we're talking about a very low graduation rate of under 10% for each of the years that it was open.
And how does that compare to the public school rate in Georgia?
So it's, you know, obviously far, far, far lower than that. And the other marker is how they were performing on milestone tests was not anywhere near what the state expected them to be.
So how is the school funded, Graduation Achievement?
So because it's a statewide charter school, it doesn't receive any local tax levies. Its funding comes from state support. In the case of Graduation Achievement, in the last year, it was about $8.8 million in state funding. And then they also get some federal funds for special education and other purposes for about a $10 million budget.
So Graduation Achievement is the only state charter school that has sought to be labeled as an alternative, quote-unquote, school by the Georgia Department of Education. So what does that mean?
Well, Graduation Achievement would tell you it ended up not meaning very much because of where they ended up, which is with closed doors. And basically in Georgia, the Georgia Department of Education allows schools to self-report if they serve an alternative population. And that's been one of Graduation Achievement schools' biggest concerns, is that they feel that Georgia has a big void in how it assesses and identifies alternative schools.
Okay. So these charter school standards, you mentioned that there are metrics and they try to factor in students of different populations in terms of income and other factors. Are there other schools or charter schools or plans to accommodate this population?
So Graduation Achievement folks very much feel that this was their mission and that they were filling a void that was not being met in the state. State Charter Commission of folks told me that these students, 1,700 or so, who will not have a diploma when the school closes, have other options. In some cases, they can return to their local school districts, and they also can attend state charter schools. Although there is concern for some of these students who've been expelled, and at last count there was maybe 70 or so of those students as to where they would be able to return to continue their education. And of course, GED is an option for some.
Students who struggled to perform in school are losing one of their options this month as the state's first virtual charter high school closes. And Vanessa McCray is with us. She's reported on whether or not online alternative charter schools set students up for success. She's a reporter for the AJC. So, Vanessa, are there models of schools like this that have succeeded here in Georgia or in other places?
So in my research, the models that the commission regularly suggested I look at and said were working are other state charter schools that serve alternative populations, but that have more of an in-person learning focus. And
right.
These are schools that are actually places where kids more regularly physically attend. Graduation Achievement did have three learning centers throughout the state in Augusta, Savannah, and Atlanta, but the bulk of the curriculum was delivered online. And I think that in the locations that are serving some alternative students where the state commission has said they've seen some success, there's been a larger focus on physical locations where there's stronger in-person teaching and wraparound services.
Right. So kids in the classroom. But I understand that virtual also works very well for a lot of bullied kids or other socially stigmatized kids.
Yeah. And it's not just bullied kids. We're talking about a population of kids who and young adults, frankly, who might be parenting or pregnant, who are working. One of the young women I spoke to had dropped out of school at age 17 and later returned and now is a 20-year-old, is preparing to leave or to graduate from Graduation Achievement. But she's been doing that while trying to balance work in fast food and retail. And so for her, an online curriculum was a necessity.
Well, you mentioned she being pregnant. I also understand that some of the population of Graduation Achievement were also former sex trafficking, people who were rescued from sex trafficking.
Yeah, so that's a statistic that the school reported to me. It's a small number, but they said they dealt with and served students who'd been in foster care, who have been victims of sex trafficking, kids who'd been previously incarcerated. Some of these factors are factors and stats the state does not collect. And so it's one way that graduation achievement argues should be somehow counted for the difficulty in educating and graduating them that the formula does not account for, because the formula can't account for things that the state doesn't collect or know about.
Right, and the state cannot also just close the doors of a school the way that a charter school can. And this is one of the complaints about charter schools. If it's not making its academic goals or revenue goals, it can just close. Are there any regulations in Georgia about that?
So the State Charter Schools Commission told me that they take very seriously their role in making sure that the schools they authorize are a good quality option for students, and that, frankly, their position is it's not really a true option if it's not a quality option.
Do any other charter schools accept students who had previously been expelled from their school?
So there are other schools that accept those expelled students. But what I saw when I was looking at the data is that, at least compared to the other two online statewide charter schools, this particular school was correct in its assertion that it was educating more of these students. And in fact, I spoke to a hearing officer who works a lot with disciplinary cases, who told me that graduation achievement was one of the top places that he and folks in his profession referred students to, because they were more accepting of students regardless of academic or disciplinary history.
Well, the superintendent, Monica Henson, told you that this raises a bigger policy question. How does Georgia deal with children who are, as she said, are least able to be advocates for themselves? Is anyone close to an answer on that?
So I think she hopes that the silver lining of this whole conversation is that it will create more awareness of these of this kind of what she considers to be a void in the educational landscape in Georgia. The Georgia Department of Education is having some conversations about what it means to be an alternative school, and they're thinking about how to perhaps more sharply define that, as well as creating a different possible way of measuring alternative school success. So there has been some larger statewide conversations about this issue.
But meanwhile, you have these 1,700 kids not getting a diploma. And how does not having a high school diploma affect someone's chances for getting a good job or creating a stable life here in Georgia?
So it's as bad as you would think for these students who don't graduate. There's an income gap a year of at least $5,000, according to studies that I looked at, for kids who don't have a college or don't have a high school degree versus those who do. And there's about 30,000 16 to 19 year olds in Georgia who are not in school and not working. So it's really a huge societal problem, which has effects far beyond just a classroom.
Well, as you know, and as an education reporter, charter schools, another issue further polarizing the country along party lines. Now, you report on Atlanta Public Schools, a low-performing district. What is the Atlanta Public Schools stance on charter schools?
So Atlanta Public Schools has taken a very receptive stance to charter schools and the flexibility that they say they can provide, working with them as both partners and as supporting them. The district authorizes about 17 charter schools that it works with. And then it also has taken the little bit more unusual step in its turnaround strategy of partnering with nonprofit charter operators to actually run some of the district's traditional schools.
Vanessa McCray, education reporter for the AJC, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, is summer to blame for the achievement gap? Especially in low-income and higher-income families, there's a growing gap between what kids leave their summer term with and how they begin the next year. But first, how the charter school movement began and how it's grown in Georgia. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than 86,000 students are enrolled in public charter schools in Georgia. This year, lawmakers approved an increase of annual funding for charter schools, ringing in at almost $18 million. Nearly 30 years since the dawn of charter schools were proposed as an alternative. How are they doing? We're getting some clarity and some contemporary Georgia perspective today from John Vallant. He's with the Brookings Institution and has extensively researched charter schools. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Kennesaw State University is Professor Ben Scafidi. He is former chair of Georgia Charter Schools Commission. And hello, Ben.
Good morning, Virginia.
Now, Ben, this has been pretty much the biggest shift in education in recent years. How did the charter school movement start, and why did it catch on?
In Georgia, it started actually fairly early after Minnesota passed their law back in 1991. And Georgia tried to go full bore back in 93 with having startup charter schools, but it really took till 1998 for the state legislature to create them. And then it really took till 2008 for the legislature to make them a really a viable option in Georgia, and it's taken off since 2008.
So Georgia was a relatively early adopter. First, a little bit on the philosophy. Why charter schools as an alternative to the public school model?
I think people thought our public schools needed to be better, and they wanted to add another option for parents.
How are charter schools funded here in Georgia?
Well, that's a good question. It depends. If they're authorized by the local school district, then they get local, federal, and state money. But all in, they get about 20% less than regular public schools. If they're funded, if they're approved straight by that state commission, then they're funded only with state and federal funds, and they probably get about 25% less than traditional public schools.
Since 1991, there are a number of for-profit entities now operating charter schools. Here's Gary Miron. He's a professor at Western Michigan University from an Intelligence Squared U.S. debate.
Today, we're looking at close to half of the nation's public charter school students are enrolled in privately operated charter schools. In my own state of Michigan, 90% of our charter schools are owned and operated by private entities. Some are nonprofit in nature, some are for-profit. Most are 80% are for-profit. This was not anticipated.
John, was this anticipated, and should there be concern about for-profit companies running schools?
I think concern is fair about for-profit companies running schools. To be clear, I think a lot of those students are in virtual charters, like the types of schools we heard about previously. So they're not necessarily the schools that people have in mind often when they think about what for-profit charter schools are. When we think about what sort of urban charter schools look like, it tends to be nonprofits that are operating those schools.
Now, there are now state charter schools and local charter schools. What's the difference, John?
Well, in Georgia, it has to do with who it is that authorizes the school. So charter schools, kind of stepping back, they are schools that operate through a contract between whoever it is that's leading the school and someone who's overseeing the school. And those authorizers can come from different places. In Georgia, they can come from the local board of education or the state board of education. And then that really has to do with who it is who's sort of overseeing and making sure that everything's going okay.
And Ben, this funding that has been approved for state charter schools in Georgia, nearly $18 million. Clarify for us, who does oversee that? Is this the board that's authorizing them?
Yeah, this is the state commission board that authorizes those. And they'll get a little bit more money to kind of get closer to what other charter schools get now.
We're talking this hour about charter schools and how they're performing in Georgia. John Vallant is with me from the Brookings Institution, and Ben Scafidi, he's now Kennesaw State University professor. And Ben, we talked earlier in the show, as you heard, about a virtual school that your former colleagues decided was not performing. How many others do not get renewed here in Georgia?
It happens. Schools don't get renewed every year. Most of them do, but some don't, one or two every year.
Do charter schools in general serve special needs and high-risk kids like we heard about?
Charter schools are very, very diverse in who they serve. A lot of them do serve those kind of students. But one thing that's generally true is charter schools serve more minority students than traditional public schools.
Now, John, there have been dozens of studies supporting pros and cons of charter school performances. But how do charter schools perform when compared to public schools in general?
So for all of those pros and cons, if you look at the best evidence we have, it looks like charter school students do about the same as we think they probably would if they were in district schools. And that is on kind of math and reading assessments that we use to measure kind of what it is that students are learning. There is some evidence that kids are doing a little bit better when it comes to high school graduation and attendance, and some evidence that students in urban charter schools are doing better than students in non-urban charter schools. But sort of across the board, the charter students don't seem to be doing much better or much worse than students in district schools.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, the idea that charter schools are serving more minority students than traditional public schools. For those wishing to tear down the system and start again, New Orleans after Katrina was proving ground and the schools became all charter schools. You studied that, John, in New Orleans and came across some of the challenges and barriers for enrollment there. What are they? How are they managed?
That's right. So New Orleans has a very unusual school system. And what happened was after Hurricane Katrina devastated the city and also the school system, they rebuilt a system that was sort of entirely decentralized and didn't use a traditional district. And now it is essentially an all charter school system where families don't get assigned to local schools based on where they live. They all have to submit a list of ranked school requests, and then there's an algorithm that places them in schools. And that system has done well in a lot of ways. Graduation rates sort of went way up and test scores are up. It has also created challenges. So people worry, for example, about whether parents who are sort of most disconnected have greater difficulty navigating a system that's more complex than the types of systems that we usually see. And then there's also some concern about what happens when you're sort of moving students across the city and whether you might lose a sort of a sense of community that builds up when you have a sort of local neighborhood school.
Mm-hmm. So transportation being one of the big challenges, getting a kid who may not be in a district to a school in another district. Is there any public transportation for that, or is that all privately funded from the school?
So this varies a lot across cities and across states, and that's sort of true of charters in general. It's always important to keep in mind that they look very different from place to place. In New Orleans actually has the most generous transportation structure I've seen. They offer yellow school bus transportation from any part of the city to any school, which is great for access because it means that families in the most disadvantaged part of New Orleans can still get to schools in just about any part of the city. It is very expensive, though.
Well, we do know that President Trump and Department of Education head Betsy DeVos have said that charter schools are civil rights. However, NAACP and Black Lives Matter movement, they contend that charter schools exacerbate segregation. So why are they opposed?
So the politics on charters, I think, are really changing right now. If you sort of go back and look at the political history of charters, they've had these really interesting political coalitions where you've had political conservatives that kind of like the idea that you have a market reform and you have competition, and you had civil rights leaders and advocates who like the idea that just like wealthier families can choose their schools by choosing where they live, charters sort of give an opportunity for poor families to choose schools. And what has happened over the last couple of years since the Trump administration has really championed charters is they have taken a much more antagonistic approach toward traditional public schools and have become kind of the face of charters. And we've seen in public opinion polling that charter schools are becoming less popular with Democrats. And the notion of what charter schools do now seems to be more that they should sort of antagonize and push public schools than that they're there to offer options to disadvantaged families.
How about that, Ben? Charter schools are often framed under this big umbrella of school choice, though not entirely containing that issue. And it's become a red meat issue. When did this become such a partisan fight?
Yeah, I think I agree with what John said. President Obama was for charter schools, and the politics changed when President Trump was elected. And I think there's a disconnect between African-American parents, for example, and then African-American advocacy organizations. African-American parents tend to support charter schools, are more likely to enroll their children there. They view them as a lifeline, but then their national advocacy organizations are now coming out full barrel against them.
What's your read on that, John?
It's an interesting point. So, and it has been true that some of those advocacy organizations have changed positions in very recent years. And we had, I mean, previously with charters, President Clinton was a supporter. As Ben said, President Obama was. And we've seen sort of a shift. And for parents, for a lot of parents, they don't necessarily concern themselves with the politics of something like charter schools. They want to make sure their kids are in a good school. And so for parents who feel good about their kids' school, who have their kids in a charter, I think there still is a lot of support for at least sort of keeping that school up and running and strong.
Ben, I've read a lot of arguments of those who are anti-charter school and then accusations, counter-accusations, that they just have this nostalgic vision of what public schools once were. What do you think? Have they lived up to the alternative to public schools?
I believe that the good ones have. And the good news is the bad ones close. They either close because their authorizer, like the state commission, closes them down. But in a lot of places, they're closed by the parents first because the parents leave. So I think that's the good news of the charter school movement.
How about for you, John? Is it living up, charter schools as a movement, living up to this promise of alternatives to public schools and delivering results?
So I think one of the real flaws with charter schools sort of from the get-go was that they overpromised what charters could deliver. So if you go back and kind of look at what the initial promise was, it was that we would get much better results out of charters with a lot more innovation in sort of experimenting with new ideas at lower cost in a way that would benefit the public school system and close gaps between historically advantaged and disadvantaged groups. And that is a really tall order. And I think it's very difficult to argue that charters have come close to delivering on that. Now, at the same time, they have done some clearly good things. For example, they have sort of helped to disprove this idea that schools that serve disadvantaged kids can't do well. I think we have a lot of evidence that there are charters that are performing really, really well. And they've created a lot more opportunities for poor families to choose than there were before. So I think they maybe have underperformed the sort of highest expectations out there, but they have done some good things.
John Vaillant, who's research public charter schools, rather, with the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Ben Scafidi, now Kennesaw State University professor, former chair of the Georgia Charter Schools Commission. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Virginia.
The cost of private school is too high for most middle and low-income families. The Council for Private American Education puts the average K through 12 tuition at more than $22,000 a year. That's like buying a new Honda LX every year for 13 years, and that's before college. One Catholic organization in Georgia is making private school more affordable to families living below the poverty line. GPB's Ricky Bevington took a look at an Atlanta school that combines a classroom setting with professional work experience.
Next, we will say our Latin prayer.
In this afternoon Latin class at Cristo Rey Atlanta's downtown building, 20 uniformed teenagers recite the words illuminated on the wall by an overhead projector. But this Catholic school is unique.
All of our students, when they come here, register for the school, and then we register them as our employees.
Bill Garrett is president of Cristo Rey Atlanta. Students, not all of them Catholic, attend class 4 days a week. A team of four rotates, working one day at a shared job. In return, 137 Metro Atlanta host companies cover 60% of their tuition, which is $17,000 a year. Families pay between $250 and $2,500, depending on their household income.
We accept a large number of students who are at a seventh grade level, and it has nothing to do with intelligence. It is the schools they come from.
Principal Diane Bush says coming to Cristo Rey can be a shock for students and parents, so the acceptance rate is less than 50%. School leaders interview every candidate and their parents. Both need to show they are ready for the rigorous academic and work schedule. Even so, Bush says about a quarter of this year's Cristo Rey class didn't make it all 4 years. 18-year-old senior Gabby Wilson is heading to Atlanta's Agnes Scott College in the fall.
We have you working in Excel a lot.
She's doing her work study at Ernst & Young's downtown Atlanta office. Before their first work study job, ninth graders go through Cristo Rey's Business Training Institute. They learn hard skills like how to use office equipment and also how to behave and dress in a professional environment, phone etiquette, public speaking, and even conflict resolution. Wearing her uniform's navy blue sweater, dark gray skirt, and knee-high socks, Wilson works on an Excel spreadsheet. She says working alongside EY accountants and auditors will come in handy when she becomes an OBGYN.
Make sure everything's precise. So when I go be in a doctor field, everything has to be precise.
Making education relevant to students outside the classroom is vital to the success of students like Wilson, says Erin Ingram, policy advisor at Civic Enterprises, a public education policy and research organization based in Washington, D.C.
Seeing a connection between what I'm doing in high school now and what I will do as an adult in the future is critical, particularly for students who are coming from less advantaged backgrounds.
In fact, a Cristo Rey student in Los Angeles once credited his math class for helping him catch an error in his company's spreadsheet, saving them money. Megan Sweese is author of Putting Education to Work. About the Cristo Rey model, she attributes some of its success to the Catholic tradition of discipline.
I found that when I was in these schools that the discipline is often a way of trying to help students realize their full potential. At the same time, if students cannot operate in a work environment, the model doesn't work.
The model is working for the more than 500 students enrolled this year. Students make it work for their future, and companies make it work for corporate social responsibility. EY partner Dave Sewell is Cristo Rey Atlanta's incoming chairman of the board.
It's not lost on us that it is, you know, for some corporations, it's a burden on their budget, right? But when people know they're doing the right thing, it comes easy.
Sewell says Cristo Rey Atlanta is discussing opening a second location. For GPB News, I'm Ricky Bevington in Atlanta.
Just ahead, schools are letting out for the summer, but should they? We take a look at the seasonal achievement gap, known as the summer slide. This is On Second Thought from GPB News.
My life, my life, my life, my life in the sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine. Sunshine. Everybody loves the sunshine.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Post-traumatic stress disorder impacts more than 31 million people at any given time in the United States. One affected but little-known population, first responders. Tomorrow we're going to talk with an Atlanta paramedic diagnosed with PTSD and want to know from you, are you a first responder who has dealt with PTSD? Do you feel that Georgia does a good job helping people with this and other mental health issues? You can call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter and Facebook. And be sure to join us at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning for more. Students of Georgia, it is that time of year.
What time is it? Summertime. It's our vacation.
What time is it?
Party time. That's right. Stay alive.
Many Georgia students are celebrating the end of the school year, but studies show halting learning for the summer can result in what is known as the summer slide. That means that students start an academic year with achievement levels below where they were at the start of summer break. For low-income and minority families, this is a big issue. Jeff Gagne is with me. He's Director of Policy Analysis at the Southern Regional Education Board. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning.
Also with me is Holly Vandentorn. She's a parent of a kindergartner, and she's a law student at Georgia State University. Hello there.
Hi, good morning.
So, Holly, you're a single mother of a child in elementary school. What are some of the challenges for you when school lets out for summer?
A big challenge is knowing what to do with him all summer long, picking camps, the different schedules that each camp has, and facilitating that. And then at the end of the day, when we both come home and we're both tired, you know, what do we do for reading, math, and kind of maintain the level from one grade to the next?
So you mentioned camps. What kinds of programs have you put your son in for the summer?
This week he's in a Boy Scout camp. He has also participated in an arts camp, sports camps. There's a wide variety of camps.
And have they helped continue his education throughout the summer?
I don't think they've helped his education. These are more fun camps, more athletic camps that really don't focus on education. They just focus on, you know, where am I going to keep my kid for the summer?
So you've had to do the kind of reading, writing yes. work yourself.
Yes.
So would you like to see Georgia schools switch to a year-long system?
I think it would be a really interesting idea to pursue and to consider. You know, there are a number of pros and cons, obviously, and it would cause a big shift for many families and parents and summer camps or other camps that might have to fill in during the school year breaks. But I do think it's an interesting idea to explore.
So, Jeff, what are some of the challenges of that, switching from a traditional school year calendar to an all-year calendar?
Wow, that's a big question. School calendars are complicated and very political. Part of this issue goes to the fact that Georgia, like many southern states, is a local control state. What does that mean? That means that the state doesn't really take a huge role in dictating a school calendar to local school districts. They choose their calendars. Many of Georgia's school districts have pushed back earlier and earlier into the summer. So we see some of them starting in as early as July, most in August now. And then a few coastal communities like Chatham County, for example, starts, you know, around Labor Day or post-Labor Day. Many school districts that are tied to strong tourism areas, beach communities, employ a lot of high school students over the summer. So they want students employed up until Labor Day because that's a problem if they're not. And that becomes very political. So states, I think, have wisely or not stayed out of trying to dictate one calendar for all and allowed local districts to kind of choose their calendar. In an ideal world, would, you know, year-round school be better for kids? Probably. Is that possible? I'm not sure that any state wants to go down that road as of this point. Now, we have districts that are doing it right now, but not the majority of districts by any means.
And how's that going for the districts who are trying it?
I think it goes fine. I don't think it's vastly different except for teachers and students who are taking, you know, more breaks that are, you know, narrower, a week, 2 weeks here over the course of the year, as opposed to 6 or 7 or 8 weeks over the summer.
So given this achievement gap, what are some of the ways in which parents can be engaged with their children in order to help close this?
I think there are, you know, summer slide is a reality. What we see nationally is a month to 2 months of loss for most kids. And it tends to hit kids from the low-income brackets harder. Part of that is overcomable. There are lots of things parents can do. Much of the problem probably goes more to knowing what to do and how to access all those things that might benefit your child over the summer months. You know, if you're traveling a lot on vacation, what can you do in the car, for example, to keep kids engaged in math and reading? Some of that can be done very subtly so they're not even aware they're doing it. And I'll give you one example at home. Cook with your kids, because one of the things you can do while you're cooking with your kids is you're reading a recipe. You can also learn to use some math skills and conversion skills at the same time as in math. That's really powerful and very subtle, and kids may not even realize they're doing those things. Reading, you know, experts in the research suggest that just 30 minutes a day, no matter where in the day, whether it's at night or in the morning, having your kids read, reading to your kids, reading together is going to help kids and their reading skills over the summer so that you can kind of stave off that loss. Science, same thing. There are lots of ways to engage kids, whether it's directly yourself or indirectly through summer camps or learning opportunities that are provided by our communities. Many of them are free. If parents are looking for free access to books, for example, there are any number of places, whether it's electronic and digitally, to check out a book for free or to get books for free through the public library, internet access through the public library. Certainly, there are any number of camps. There are summer school programs if your district offers them. Some might provide some federal assistance to poorer kids. The problem for many parents, and we talked about this earlier, might be an issue of transportation. How do I get my child here? How do I pick my child up? Because I work all day.
Yeah, well, what's that like for you, Holly? I mean, you told me earlier you're mm-hmm. taking two classes this summer. How do you know? Do you have driving time with your kids? So
it's
your son,
very
rather?
Difficult. Every summer camp has a different schedule. I use a lot of babysitters to fill in. I'm the sole caretaker of my son, and I don't have family here. So just juggling all the schedules is very difficult.
And how about the cost of that?
It can be very expensive. Summer camps can run anywhere from $200 to $400. There are some less expensive ones, but then they're half a day. And so it's, how do I pick up my child in the middle of the day? I have to leave my office. I have to log back in online when I get back home. And then my son is kind of on his own while I'm working.
Well, Jeff, where are we seeing this achievement gap? Is this a sort of urban, rural? Is it a low income, higher income? Where do they start to part ways during the summer?
I don't think we're seeing it based on any kind of locale issue. It's largely, we're seeing more of it on the, in the low-income student brackets, but I think it's largely because what we're talking about is parents in many cases who are working one or two jobs, both working, single parents who are working a full-time job. So for all those single parents out there, you're amazing, because how you're doing that and augmenting your child's education, that's really tough to do together. So figuring out how to juggle all that and ensure your child is getting what they need is really tough. I think it's possible, but I think it's harder for poorer parents than it is for wealthier parents who might have a parent who's not working or might have the context to know where to find these things. If you've gone to college, you probably have a larger context about where I can find these resources or who I can ask for these resources. Part of this falls back to a community and a school district and a school to ensure that all the parents have some understanding come the summer that here are all the things that are available to your child to stave this loss. And if you have any question or need any help, we're here to assist you. And here's a number you can call.
We're talking about the summer achievement gap. My guests are Jeff Gagne. He's at the Southern Regional Education Board. Also, Holly Vandertorn is a parent of a kindergartner and a law student at Georgia State University. Well, Holly, what do you think? You just got a shout out as a single mom.
Thank you.
But is there a difference for urban versus rural families when it comes to switching to a year-long schedule, for example?
I do think that there is. My sister, who lives in a rural community in Canada, I spoke to her about this, and she really values that time in the summer to reconnect with her kids. But there are also children that need to work on the farm. They need to be working all summer long in order to support family business. And so I think in the urban communities, it's a lot easier. We don't have that obligation of agrarian lifestyle. And we have this need to fill this gap of where do we send our children all day long and how do we mitigate that achievement gap over the summer. So year-round school seems to make sense to me.
Yeah, that's something I hear, Jeff, from parents. You know, summer's coming. Oh, what am I going to do with the kids? Mm-hmm. And that seems to fall along a couple of different lines, especially class lines. You know, summer is the time for going to the camp, that kind of thing. But imagine spending a hot, long summer inside of an urban area.
I have imagined it. and it is hot. The one thing that the urban areas bring to bear on this situation is that, you know, a city the size of Atlanta has a lot to offer kids in the summertime and parents. You've got access to museums and parks. Piedmont Park, for example, offers a series of summer camps that are a week long each. So there are lots of things you can avail yourself. Some will cost money. Some may not cost money, like the Children's Museum, for example. If you live in a rural area, you might be harder to access some of those things the urban folks have. On the other hand, you may have access to other things that urban folks don't have.
I want to know if there are particular grades that are important to keep kids involved during the summer, either with camps or programs or reading schedules.
You know, we've talked a lot about that. And certainly in the early grades where reading is so important to pre-K to three development, so that kids are coming out proficient at reading at the end of fourth grade, because that's a huge indicator of success. But the other issue is what we say in middle school and high school is that summer school can be an area of activity for enrichment. So, and we see a lot of high school and college students who are getting a leg up on time to degree, for example. So I can cut my time to earn a degree or a certificate by utilizing summer to get 3 hours of credit or 6 hours of credit, or from high school, taking dual enrollment credits in the summer and getting a leg up on that college degree once I enroll. So it cuts across the education pipeline. Summer can help everybody.
So I'm thinking about some of my most distinct memories as a kid are not, you know, going to school every day, but of summer, those long yawning hours of summer of doing absolutely nothing. Is there a benefit to being a little more free range in the summer, Jeff?
I think you can be free range and still do some learning. 30 minutes of reading a day isn't asking a lot. That's not a huge amount of time. And the 30 minutes seems to be really significant research-wise. So I'd suggest that find a day, a time in the day, and say to your child, we're going to turn off the technology, we're going to come inside, and we're going to get out of the heat and take a break, and we're going to read for 30 minutes together.
Holly, is that something you're doing? Is your son using a reading list this summer?
Yes, we do have a reading list that was provided by our school. So we are going down the list, and we'll be going to the library quite a bit this summer
to check out books.
And are you trying to create some free range time for your son as well?
Definitely. I actually have 2 weeks in June. My work schedule is a little bit more flexible and he will be staying home. I'll have a mother's helper for some time, and that time is really going to be spent him just doing his thing, reading, playing, no to low technology. And because I do think that it is important that kids get that break and they're not always active, not always in some program or activity. They do need that downtime.
I know even at summer camps now, they're asking kids to often leave their technology behind. How do you do that, Jeff, when you're not the camp counselor, but you're the parent who they can argue with?
You tie that technology directly to, you know, some, in essence, to a reward. In my house, for the 30 minutes of reading, you get the 30 minutes of time on your Kindle. So there's this even exchange for a little schoolwork as opposed to a little fun work. And my suggestion would be find a theme in books that your child likes, whether it's horses or elephants or cars, whatever that might be, and get books that child is a subject they're interested in reading about, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, so that they're reading. It doesn't say that it has to be nonfiction novels, for example, but it has to be anything that they read that's going to enlarge their vocabulary and their reading ability and challenge them.
So, Jeff, you mentioned there are a number of programs for low-income families who can't necessarily afford summer programs or childcare. So where would you steer them to help give them some guidance?
I would start with your local school and school district and the local public library. Public libraries are great at providing reading lists by grade level and subject. So if you have access to a public library, you know, find out what they're recommending or what's hot on the reading list this year and check it out. And if you can't check it out, see if you can borrow it somewhere else. A lot of neighborhoods have their own little local public library box on the book corner, or, you know, go to a used bookstore, and because, God, they're a great place for cheap books. There are lots of places to avail yourself. It's just a matter of looking.
Well, Jeff Gagne, thank you so much for speaking
with
us. Jeff is Director of Policy Analysis at the Southern Regional Education Board. Also joining me today, thanks so much, Holly Vandertorn.
Thank you.
She's a law student at Georgia State University, taking two courses this summer herself and a parent of a kindergartner. They talked with us about the summer achievement gap and how parents can keep their kids engaged in education over the long, hot summer. And that's our show for today. But before we go, let's hear from you. We recently started a series on different cultural interpretations of Southern barbecue and tasted some Brazilian barbecue, which in Portuguese is called churrasco. Mateus Garcia of Southern Brazil wrote, "When we lived in the country, sometimes my dad would go to farms with a friend or two and have a cow or lamb, usually pigs though, slaughtered to make a churrasco. And until I moved from my parents, I thought it was normal to eat beef every day." We asked you to tell us about your favorite barbecue joints. Listener Charles Miller left us a voicemail to talk up this eatery.
My favorite barbecue place in Georgia is the Hickory Pig in Gainesville, Georgia. The barbecue is fantastic, but Phil puts on a show that you can't believe. Get him to go out back to the gazebo and sing Blueberry Hill in his gazebo. Great food, but nothing touches the show he puts on as an owner of a barbecue place. You got to go there.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill.
Nothing says Southern hospitality like barbecue. Thanks so much for your comments. We'd love to know, where do you get your barbecue? Have you tried some of the ethnic takes on this slow-cooked deliciousness? You can leave us a message at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter and Facebook at OST Talk. Our show is produced by Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Susan Davis is our executive producer. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting.